Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight we've got an unusual show for you. And I've got so many interesting presentations for you. I'm not even going to start with music and my news. I'm going to go right into the first presentation. This is Mr. Frank Cummings, who spoke at the rally in Naples last Tuesday night. Here we go.
So tell me your name.
My name is Frank Cummings. I'm from Golden Gate Estates out here in Naples, Florida.
And you're with the Preserve Our Paradise.
Yes,
group.
I'm a member of Preserve Our Paradise.
What's Preserve Our Paradise all about?
Preserve Our Paradise was formed when we found out that Collier Resources, along with Dan Hughes, were going to drill an oil well out 1,000 feet from residential property in Golden Gate Estates.
So is your concern, or perhaps the concern of your membership, about the impact of on your property values of this drilling?
I think that's part of it. I think that's a serious part of it, but even more serious would be the contamination of water. The contamination of water stands a greater chance of happening with this type of well than anything else. So they're telling us that the ejection wells are going to use 5 million gallons of water to drill this well down to 13,000 feet, and that's ridiculous.
Now, this hearing today is for the permitting for one installation, correct?
That's correct. That's for the injection water well, correct.
So there are already a small number of drills that have been operating in this area for 30, 40 years. What makes this different?
It makes it quite a bit different. In other words, 30 or 40 years ago, how many people did you have living within the Golden Gate area? We now have in excess of 30,000 residents that live on well water alone. There's quite a bit of difference in drilling a well from 1940 into the year 2014. There's a total difference in population. There's a total disbursement of how the water gets absorbed. I mean, I'm not a geologist, but if you start taking 5 million gallons of water from the underground, from our aquifers, okay, that can cause sinkholes, and that's been proven already.
I mean, again, not to question your motives, but again, this effort is really being spurred because of development eastward from the city of Naples into Everglades and into Panther territory. Right? I mean,
correct.
It's basically about the property values.
Correct, but also about the environment and the panthers, because of the fact that there are actually three dens that are located within a mile of the drill site. And they also didn't have a contingency plan. The fire department cannot possibly evacuate the population in case of a spill, of the gaseous spill that could happen out of an oil well. It's totally incompetent. The fire department cannot utilize four men and a truck and evacuate Golden Gate because they're all one-way streets.
Speaking of the streets, where are the access roads for this going to be?
The access road goes right down 24th, right off of DeSoto, right down a residential street.
Right, so again, impacting the property value.
Impacting property values. When they start drilling, if they get the permission to do this, this will go on for 24/7 for, 30 days, however long it takes them to go down 13,000 feet. And then they want to do horizontal drilling. So you're talking about acid fracking, you're talking about the different type of fracking that goes on in Florida is completely different than the rest of the country because of the way our composition is made up of the subsurface, which is mostly limestone. Anybody will tell you that's a geologist. They don't know where that next water is going to go once it gets reinjected, they said, down into the boulders. And once the water gets contaminated, it's contaminated forever.
And now, a representative of the First Peoples, Mr. Bobby C. Billy.
Excuse me. I would like to give Bobby C. Billy my minutes. He has lots to say. He represents First Nation people here, and we would do well to listen to him.
Thank you. Pompo, Madhu. I'm here to speak. The God's creation have no voice. I'm here to speak for them, which is Mother Earth, as the same as a mother. You've been abusing the man, abusing the mothers throughout the world. What you do is abusing a banish of the a Mother Earth. It's dying. Air's dying. Water's dying. The people's getting sick. Everybody got crippled. Even unborn life is not going to come because of changing environments. Everything disappearing before the eyes of all creations. Think about that. Don't think about the money. Think about your grandkids going to be born. Yeah. What you going to pass it on to? The money's not going to help them if you lose all those things, environments and resources. You're taking their life away from them. Our people's not like that. We protect them, the future, their generation, not this generation. That's what you need to look for. Protect their future generation, unborn life, which has been grass, ants, all creation of the God that gave us. We need to protect that. That's what we call a Mother Earth is. It's the same as the mother. You need to take care of them. So can everything can come and continue living on God's creation. It doesn't belong to us. They're talking about the resource. It doesn't belong to us. It owned us. When we pass away, we don't have nothing. We go back to the Mother Earth. Think about that. Take what you need, what the Creator has told us. That's what we have been living, and our people have been that way. Until about 500 years ago, everything started changing. We've been struggling since. Non-trees, animals, ants, insects, we have been struggling because of your people, what you're doing in the environment. Wake up before you kill the ball creation of the God's gift. Thank you.
Next, Amber Crooks of Florida Conservancy.
Amber Crooks, Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Please give me my moment. We're talking today on behalf of our 4,500 members and as a property owner in the area. We have shared concerns throughout this process. Today we want to share concerns that this committee has not been given an appropriate amount of time, only a few days, to do their due diligence on this project. If DEP was sincere about utilizing the expertise of this committee, it would not only have been able to give the information well in advance of the meeting, but would have in fact called upon them during the permitting process instead of after the fact when the permit has already been issued. Doing so now seems like an attempt to justify an appropriately awarded permit. There is no question that this project takes place within the Big Cypress watershed area as defined by Florida statute. However, DEP decided that the committee should not convene because the project was agricultural lands with little value, they say. However, the Florida statute states that each application should be reviewed by the committee. Likewise, given the project's classification as a project of heightened public concern, we're all here, impact to vegetation for that access road, likely utilization by protected species, and adjacent wetlands of regional significance, the committee should have been convened well in advance of today. The Conservancy has submitted its own substantial concerns about the project to DEP, but no changes were incorporated into the final permit. There are significant impacts to consider, everything from impacts to the Stumpy Slough, its areas used as a floodplain reservoir, the primary panther habitat, and lack of wildlife surveying, lack of traffic impact analysis. We have four recommendations that we may have to also provide you via email that we would like to see DEP and the Big Cypress Committee take a look at, and that includes things such as making sure the protective levee is sufficient to protect from stormwater runoff and spills from polluting the adjacent wetland flowway that feeds into the Pickering Strand. Right now, it's only a 2-foot earthen berm. We also want to make sure that they speak with the federal U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service about the panther impacts, and why hasn't FWC also spoken about the other imperiled species that exist on the site?
Next, we've got Jaime Duran, who's a neighbor to the well site.
My name is Jaime Duran. I live 1,000 feet west of the proposed site at 4880 24th Avenue Southeast. Thank you for listening. With nearly a year of research, I would like to set straight some of the lies we have heard. Drilling is safe. There is ample evidence documenting disastrous accidents contradicting this platitude repeated by so many times by the Colliers and Hughes companies. It won't happen here. There are documented reports of 17 oil wells and waste brine spills in southwest Florida. One at Raccoon Point impacted 100 acres. It will bring high-paying jobs to the area. In southwest Florida, state officials guesstimate that only 30 or 40 people are employed in oil production full-time. There is no gas in South Florida. Hydrogen sulfide gas was detected at 200 parts per million in a well at Raccoon Point, enough to cause the well to shut down. And every well in South Florida has a flare to burn excess gas. It will make us energy independent. Another half-truth. The only ones that will become independently rich are the oil barons. This oil, if any, will be sold to the highest bidder outside of the U.S. I have been told half-truths and outright lies by county officials, by the FDEP, by Collier Resources, and by Dan A. Hughes. As the Nazis stated during World War II, if you tell a lie enough times, people will see it as true. Right. Yeah. Do you really believe this lie? It's about the water. Do not believe the lie. Do the right thing. Recommend to deny the permit. Thank you very much.
Next, John Dwyer.
Jennifer Hecker, on behalf of the Conservancy of Southwest Florida and our more than 4,500 members, we are a landowner in the proposed project area as well. Groundwater in our aquifers provide drinking water to 90% of Floridians. Injecting hazardous wastewater through them underground in this well poses a significant threat of contamination to our water supply here in Collier County, with Collier's public well fields being less than 1 mile away from the proposed injection site. Based on EPA records, we know that injection wells, including Class 2 wells, can leak, as documented by EPA. We're already facing freshwater shortages, fighting to keep saltwater intrusion and rising fluoride levels from contaminating what remains of our dwindling freshwater supply. Thus, we have serious concerns that even the potential threat to our aquifers from this project is not within the public's interest and poses an unacceptable risk to our water supply. To adequately address and ensure sufficient protection of groundwater in relation to this project, additional actions would be needed. One, require specifically in the EPA permit that a mechanical integrity test be performed every year instead of every 5 years. Similarly, language regarding loss of mechanical integrity should be strengthened. The draft permit states that operations may continue if there's no movement of fluid into drinking water supplies, but some staff has itself pointed out that this would be difficult to impossible to determine. The permit should require that the well be shut down, requiring the applicant to provide the volumes of chemicals utilized in the drilling process. Likewise, EPA should request the concentrations of all chemicals. There's many other deficiencies that I won't be able to get into, so we submitted our more extensive comments in writing on all of these regulatory deficiencies in your draft permit. We believe that this permit should not be issued, and we are asking that you deny it. We have relayed this to you, and again, we provided you additional comments for the record today. Thank you.
No one should be allowed to use the Everglades as a dumping ground. This well is permitted to destroy 5 million gallons of water every month. And unlike agricultural water, the drilling water can never be reused. It is permanently polluted and must be injected into the highly transmissive and cavernous boulder zone. Given Florida's highly porous and fractured limestone geology, we wonder exactly where the wastewater will ultimately end up, all 15 million gallons of it per month. The risk seems great that it will travel and contaminate the nearby freshwater aquifers, since recent studies show that injected fluids migrate and surface. Wastewater contains more than just saltwater brine. As the EPA website warns, brine can also contain, quote, toxic metals and radioactive substances. I'll just complete it later, second round.
Thank you. By the way, these voices from the Naples hearings were brought to us through the good offices of independent producer Steve Malagodi. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Rebecca Wakefield from SEIU Local 1991 and Subhash Katil from One Miami here to bring us the SEIU Tallahassee update. Take it away, folks.
Thanks, Rick. Really appreciate you having us on.
Our pleasure.
I get into Tallahassee, thank you. Before I get into Tallahassee, I just wanted to note that, you know, some of the numbers came out recently for enrollment in Obamacare, and it's pretty encouraging that Florida is one of the top states in the nation for enrollment. That's even despite a lukewarm governor who's done almost nothing to help people get the health care they need, and an openly hostile Republican leadership in the legislature that's done everything it possibly can to make it harder for people to sign up. Even with all that, almost 450,000 Floridians have signed up as of this month, which I think is something to really celebrate. It also says that there's a big need out there and a huge desire for people to get quality health care. So, you know, we're still not even halfway there for all the people who are eligible for that. And certainly we're not even talking about Medicaid expansion, which would also cover people who fall in the gap, who make maybe a little too much to qualify for Medicaid, but not quite enough to qualify for supplements. And that's something the legislature could do something about at any time, and they've so far chosen not to do it, but just wanted to note that. Here's an example of something that happened in Tallahassee this week. Senate Bill 1364 is a bill that would raise the number of hours worked to qualify for health benefits under ACA from 25 hours a week to 30 hours a week. That bill passed in its first health care committee, and the measure would potentially put more Floridians in the Medicaid coverage gap that would have otherwise been covered by their employer. So that's, you know, bit by bit some things are happening. But overall, the legislature seemed to move to focus on reducing the political drama of last year and helping the governor get reelected. You know, the priority of the leadership was towards supporting his $500 million in tax and fee reductions, including $400 million in motorist fee reductions, which the governor has pushed, and which arguably maybe isn't the highest priority for some of the needs of the people in the state of Florida. But there were several other bills we had our eyes on this week. One of them was House Bill 7113. That is a bill that would allow advanced registered nurse practitioners, also known as ARNPs, to write prescriptions for certain controlled substances without the supervision of a physician. That's really good because these ARNPs are very highly skilled, very highly trained, and in most states in this country are allowed to do that and some other things. Florida has one of the most restrictive practice environments in the nation, largely due to lobbying by physicians, unfortunately, but actually expanding the scope of practice for ARNPs would bring down healthcare costs and would make more healthcare available to more people because there's a lot more ARNPs than there are physicians in the state, and many healthcare issues can be taken care of at that level. So getting that through is definitely a good thing, and fortunately that seems to be moving. It passed out of its first committee this week on an 8-4 vote. And SEIU, the Nurses Association, and the Florida Chamber are all in support of that. So we're hoping that that's going to go through. House Bill 957 is a bill that would preempt local wage theft protection ordinances that have been implemented by counties like Miami-Dade and Broward. That is not a good thing. Miami-Dade and Broward have passed wage theft ordinances that help protect the working people so that they keep the money that they earn. This bill would actually make those ordinances moot, and that's not something that we're supporting at all. That did pass in its first House committee, obviously along party lines, and we'll be following that very closely. Another bill that we looked at this week was Senate Bill 220. This is a bill by Senator Thompson, a Democrat from Orlando, that would protect pregnant women from discrimination in employment and public services. It's passed its final Senate committee, and it's going to be heading to the Senate floor for a final vote. One of the most encouraging things that happened in Tallahassee this week is House Bill 851. This is a bill that would grant in-state tuition to undocumented students and military veterans who meet certain requirements. It has cleared its final House committee. It will head to the full House for a vote. And the Senate has a companion bill that it will be taking up early next week. So that's pretty much what we were looking at this past week. Subhash, are you on the line? Hello?
I'm here.
Great, awesome.
I'm here.
So Subhash is going to let us in on what's coming up in the week ahead. What's going on this week?
There's a couple things going on this week, and the one thing is a continuation of one of the more exciting developments in the session, which is that in-state tuition, meaning that Floridians that have called Florida their home for the majority of their lives, that have went to school here and went to college here, may have a real shot at all getting in-state tuition. A lot of undocumented immigrants that have called Florida their home for almost the majority of their lives have not been able to pay in-state tuition for years now in Florida, and that might be coming to an end. We'll see the developments, and that's something to pay really close attention to. There's going to be a few other things around. Places like Miami-Dade have made things like wage theft illegal. That means when an employer decides to literally steal the wages, rob the wages of their employers, not pay them overtime pay, not pay them the money that they owe them. And a place like Miami-Dade County, what you may not know is that a few years back, under Jeb Bush, Florida abolished its Department of Labor. So the only folks that you can kind of fight labor claims with are the feds, or in some cases like Miami-Dade County, you could fight it with the local county government. Now, there's a bunch of bills pending at the statewide level that are going to try to preempt these bills. What preemption means is they're going to try to say only the states can regulate things like wage theft. Problem with that is we don't have a Department of Labor. So that's something to really, 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 really pay attention to that's coming down the pipeline. There's going to be more stuff around nursing home litigation and public health trust. But then there's one very specific thing. So in a place like Florida where you have an overdependence on the service economy, the fact of the matter is people always talk about making Florida open for business, but what Florida really has to do is pay its workers a little bit better, because if you don't pay your workers better in Florida, your economy is always going to suck, and that's just the plain end of it. When minimum wage workers and low wage workers have a little bit more money in their pocket, they go down the street to buy more stuff, and those small businesses get a little bit more money, you know, go down the street to buy a few more products from the suppliers, and that's what keeps the economy rolling, not giving tax breaks to billionaires. Senator Dwight Bullard, who's been a champion for a bunch of issues, is going to be calling off Florida to hear bills that would raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. Now, $10.10 an hour is significant, and you'll see in the coming weeks there's going to be a nationwide campaign that will be called the Fight for 15 to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Folks like Senator Dwight Bullard know that it's going to be a real, real, real uphill battle to fight for 15 in Florida over here, but he wants the minimum wage to at least be $10.10 an hour. And that's something to really, really look out for. I think that out of all the bills that I see, as whether they're promising or not, as bills that really address what's wrong with Florida, which is the fact of the matter is we have politicians that care about big business folks more than they care about low-wage workers, I think that bill is a bill we should really, really be paying attention to.
Great. And that's all I have to say. And you mentioned Dwight Bullard, and I have to say that I remember last year he spent, I think, a week trying to live on minimum wage just to see what it was like. And really what that's like. And I think that's amazing to have a legislator actually do that and live and try to catch public transportation and try to buy food and everything that goes into, you know, what a minimum wage worker has to deal with on a daily basis. So I think
and I would really love to see our governor, our attorney general, you know, the head of the Senate, the head of the House, do that same thing of try to live on minimum wage in Florida for a week and report back. I would love to see that.
Right, or to live on, you know, less than Rick Scott's millions. That would be nice. I mean, it's just great leadership when you have somebody who's willing to walk a day or a week in the shoes of an average Floridian. And so I think that says a lot. When we do have some leadership who do that, we really need to support them in what they're trying to do. So that's pretty much it. We appreciate having our few minutes on your show, Rick, and thank you very much. And we'll
it's our pleasure.
And
as Subhash has pointed out, it really works to Tallahassee's advantage with that big isolation from the real population centers in central and southern Florida. And they really get away with murder up there simply because of that isolation. And we know that the reporting from the south end of the state in what's the commercial media is just ridiculously modest. So I really appreciate the work that you guys are doing to bring us the facts of what's really going on in Tallahassee. I can't thank you enough. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Okay, we'll talk to you next week, okay, with next week's Tallahassee Report.
All right.
Okay, and now we're going to go back to another one of our reports from the Naples EPA conference. Here we go. This is from Bradley Rosendorf.
Sure. What was I saying?
Oh, about why you were here. You found out about this, et cetera?
Yeah, I found out about it just like on the internet, looking at Everglades pictures and stuff, just Googling Everglades, and I saw it on the come up on the news thing. Like I was saying before, you know, I've grown up down here. I went to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. To me, I mean, the elementary school that I went to, the Panther was our mascot. I have the little tiny little shirt at home with the Panther on, and it's just like, being a Floridian, to me, I thought this is like the core of our pride of being, this is what our state is preserving the Everglades. And it's just, I mean, the tourist industry is huge down here, but that's one part of it. But I mean, just the fact that we're talking about clean water, that's our ability to live down here. And it's like, no matter how safe they say that their techniques are, no matter how safe they are, there's going to be a problem, you know. And so, and isn't it true that this kind of technique is unprecedented down here? This is the first time they're trying to do this. And so it's unpredictable what could happen. And we're talking about our aquifer, and they're spending billions of dollars with the federal government trying to restore the Everglades, get to preserve the flow of water, prevent the saltwater intrusion, all that kind of stuff. They're spending billions of dollars to preserve our water, and they're coming in here and doing this. And it's just like, it's hard to believe. It really is. It's like, it's madness. It's like the Twilight Zone. It's just disheartening. You know, I understand the importance of panthers and the wildlife and stuff like that, but it really is about the clean water. And it's just sad. It's just sad. You know, and I came out here today, I said, I just want to remain calm, not get too worked up, and just watch what's going on. See, are the EPA people really going to come down here and be on our side? Or is this just a stunt, and they're coming down here, and it's a show, and they're going to come and basically defend the industry and then use things that we say in there to figure out the best way to market stuff. And then they can say, well, we had a democratic process here. The people came out. We discussed it, and, you know, we're moving forward with it. And so, you know, it's just disheartening. It's like, I don't know. I don't know what else to say. You know, I'm pretty pessimistic that they're going to put a halt to this. So, but it's important to come out here and be witness to what's going on.
What's your name?
Bradley Rosendorf from Florida Atlantic University, Department of Sociology.
Thanks, Bradley.
Another one of those excellent reports from the field from independent producer Steve Malagodi. And now we've got our next guest on. I think this is Leanne and Eric. Leanne and Eric, welcome.
Hello. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Very good, very good. Well, my friends, you're here to talk to us about the state of AIDS health affairs here in South Florida. What's the news, friends?
Well, right now, Richard, the last time we spoke with you and with your audience, basically we were sharing with you that we were in the process of widening our horizons by working with the counties, and it actually turned out to be more beneficial for us than we expected because we were able to land a contract with the lead agency, which the lead agency now is the Department of Health. And we are now a peer-to-peer advocacy program besides the support group network. It's opened the doors for us to monitor the providers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're pretty much now monitoring the providers in the area and also the clients to bridge that gap between the clients and the providers to make sure the clients stay in treatment, the providers can assure that the treatment is being rendered correctly and that they're following procedures to the letter what the state requires.
Well, that's great. I'm so glad to hear the work that you're doing, finding some important support. Last time we were talking, if I'm not mistaken, you were saying that too many people think that the crisis is over. Where do we stand in terms of AIDS exposure, and are we seeing a decrease, or are we still seeing an increase in AIDS infections?
Well, right now in our area, it's ironic you bring that topic up because last year during World AIDS Day, they mentioned that the numbers pretty much had leveled off, but that was the numbers that they used. The numbers that they used were numbers that contained those who were been diagnosed and those who have been living with the disease for over, let's say, 10-plus years. But those who are newly diagnosed, which range anything between the age of 13 all the way up to the 26 age group, are the ones that we are kind of having a most difficult with because they have this complacency of actually thinking that the disease is not a major problem, that just taking a pill a day will basically take care of the situation and that they should have not to worry about anything else because they just have to take that one medication, which I don't know if you're aware of this, but they've actually came out with certain medications now that are like 3-in-1, 4-in-1, where it makes it easier for that individual to take their medication instead of taking multiple different types of medications, they're just taking one. But at the same time, that's opened up a double-edged sword where it's actually given the individual the complacency of thinking that the disease itself is easy to manage because it's one pill a day if they're under that regimen, or that the fact is that they don't hear as much information out there or any kind of, PSA that are out there, public service announcements, talking about HIV and AIDS within our area because of the fact that they don't really push the issue anymore. Truth of the matter is AIDS is still out there. HIV is still infecting many people out there. In our area right now, as it stands, we actually have an increase of those who are living with AIDS because they have transformed from being HIV positive to having AIDS, and that actually has jumped. Right now in St. Lucie County is ranked number 10 in the state of Florida, which maybe to certain people that sounds great because at one time we were ranked like number 2, but still, that's still a high that's still a very high ranking considering the size of St. Lucie. No.
Absolutely. Now, are we seeing any particular age group with a declining number of infections, or is it pretty much across the board from teenagers through people in their 50s and 60s?
Well, those who are actually between the ages 40 and plus, those are the ones who are considered long-term survivors. majority of them. They have been living with a disease for 10-plus years. So a lot of them are under treatment. They have their virus under control through treatment. So we're not seeing such an increase in that number, that age group. But the age group between 13 to 26, 27, we're seeing an increase, especially, I don't know if you've heard, the category of MSMs, men who have sex with men. These men do not consider themselves heterosexual. They do not consider themselves homosexual. They do not consider themselves bisexual. They actually are just men who have sex with other men, and a majority of them have wives, family, and everything at home, but they're out there doing the wrong thing, pretty much, and bringing home the virus or any other STD back to their families. So we're seeing an increase in that category as the years have gone by, you know, and the numbers actually are jumping up to 49% in our area, and that's the males category.
Can I add something here?
Please.
And yes, when you see the reality, when we're talking in, it's just an abstract when you don't have it, okay? It's like, it's a very abstract thing. But when you deal with the reality of it, like Eric and I do, and you meet a newly diagnosed person, for instance, and you see the numbers and you know the reality behind all of it, any person, now I consider Florida to be a petri dish of HIV. HIV loves Florida, particularly because it's considered a place where you go to have fun, you vacation, it's transient. You've got a lot of baby boomers who do not think they have to use any protection because no one can get, you know, that age group can't get pregnant anymore. Believe me, those gated communities have HIV in them, okay? So when you see the reality of it, it's people who are inclined to have unprotected sex. So you're talking about the MSMs, you're talking about the 13 to 25-year-olds, you're talking about the older community. It's all of those people are opening the door, and it's not just HIV. Okay, syphilis is big in Florida. All of the STDs are thriving in Florida, okay? So it's just the lifestyle. It's that mindset of I'm here to have fun, okay? That is the mindset that opens the door to HIV, and it's traumatic. I mean, people have no idea that, I mean, especially the young people who think I'll just take a pill, you know, say the young gay population, they're famous for saying, it's okay, I'll just take a pill. No, it's not like that, okay? You must report to the doctor every 3 months and be monitored very closely because the virus affects every individual differently. Depending on your DNA. So you are immediately at the mercy of the health field. You must be enrolled. You must follow protocol. It's not something to be trifled with. It's not something to be messed with. And that's not even opening the topic of disclosure. How do I tell people? I mean, that's not something people like to think about, but we see it. We see the reality, and it's absolutely traumatic. And, you know, this medication is wonderful and everything when it works and when it's taken properly, but this is something you must take faithfully every day. And they used to say, oh, it's okay, you can wait a while. Not anymore. They don't mess with it. You go on that medication, you stay on that medication, you start missing doses, and the virus jumps right in and becomes resistant in many cases, not all cases. So it's extremely, it's an intense reality slap. So, you know, people, I just feel bad because people who don't think that they are they might
at
they
risk?
Probably
yeah.
it's not me at risk. Yeah. Anybody who's had sex, I mean, that was me. Okay. I wasn't a drug dealer. I didn't do drugs. Okay. I mean, I wasn't like, I didn't fool around. This is my boyfriend that was madly in love with that gave it to me in the 80s, and he had hemophilia. That's how, and so, you know, I've been through it. I've been through that horrible reality and just trauma, okay? And when I think of all the people out there that are engaging, when you have, if a person, any person, I don't care if you're 80 or if you're 20, you have sex with a person, it's unprotected, you're having sex basically with that every person that person's ever had sex with or had exchanged bodily fluids with. And so I don't know. I don't know how else to say it. And you know, you're feeding a billion-dollar industry. This is a billion-dollar industry. People don't understand that. You know, you are now in part of a billion-dollar industry that you will participate in, like it or not. That doesn't go over very well. So, you know, you're now tied to this thing that you cannot release yourself from. It's traumatic. I don't know what else to say, you know, but people, I don't know. It's not me. It's not in my backyard, but that's not the world that Eric and I live in, and it's sad.
Well, you know, you're the people who know what's really going on. You're the ones that cut through the myths. Let me ask you this. When, if a person is facing that horrible reality that they've had sex with everyone who that other person just had sex with, where do they go? What is the procedure? How do they deal with that fact?
Well, if I was in charge of this of the country, I would say,
yeah,
all right, enough with this. Everybody gets tested. This is ridiculous. Okay, people are getting infected. They don't need to be. Everybody needs to know their status, because if you take Hep C, which is three times more prevalent than HIV, especially in the baby boomers, and you take all the other STDs and you put HIV combined, we're talking about a huge chunk of the population. Okay, that is the world we live in. But people pussyfoot around it because they want their privacy rights, whatever, okay? The reality is there are so many things out there that people are getting exposed to all the time. So it's just the day and age where I don't know when the light bulb is going to go on, but everybody who's ever had sex once unprotected should go out and have a full screening. And it doesn't cost a lot of money to have an STD screening. You can go anywhere and get it done, okay? Especially Hep C if you're of a certain age. All the baby boomers are supposed to be doing that, but they – you know, it's the law. You can't force anybody to have a Hep C. But that's just the world we live in. But for some reason, it's just not out there. But that is reality. So it's not just HIV. It's all of them.
Richard, basically, getting back to your question, where would the person go to? Well, I would tell that person automatically is to contact the nearest county health department. The county health department will test the person, and majority of them will do it for free. There are other sites, other locations that might be in your area, but you need to find out which agency is doing testing in your local area. In our area here in the Treasure Coast, you have multiple sites that are excellently coordinated to be in certain areas that are high prevalent to the HIV virus. So basically, an individual who wants to get tested could actually just contact the health department and set up an appointment to get tested. There are certain sites also that come out to you wherever you want to meet them. They even go to your home to get tested. You also have the rapid testing, which you don't have to no longer take the swab. You could actually get the results within 20 minutes, which is an excellent thing to have now these days. The ironic thing is like Leanne stated, is that, you know, we, as much as all these things are out there, it's up to that individual to take the appropriate procedure in regards to taking that correct road on and actually guiding themselves to the right assets that are out there that they could actually use without, one, being charged for, two, without having to worry about their insurance or anything like that. So I always tell a person, listen, your best bet is going to the county health department. Let them deal with you. let them work with it out with you, and they'll set up an appointment. And if there's another site in your area, as we have multiple ones in our area, we can guide that person to the appropriate site for them that's nearest to them, you know. So it's kind of weird because we've had cases where individuals won't want to get tested, not in their area. They'll actually drive from Okeechobee all the way into St. Lucie County to get tested because they're afraid that somebody might find out just because they're entering the Department of Health that they'll know that they're going in there for an HIV test, which that's crazy. How would they know? You know, the point comes down to is just that stigma for you. Stigma is prevalent in our area. It's huge. And as much as we keep on fighting it, it just seems to continue to grow because of the lack of education. The funds have been cut in many different ways. And so one of the areas that has been cut has been in the educational arena, where at one time you used to look at a person who was actually, would be someone who was negative, to be getting tested as much as possible. But now they're looking at those who are positive to actually get the word out and also to make sure that they understand that it's up to them to make the right call when it comes to protecting themselves and their partners and anybody around them, because the truth of the matter is you cannot get HIV from somebody who's negative, you know. So if you have somebody who's positive out there, I reassure that person, telling them, listen, you got to protect yourself, you got to take your medication correctly. If you take your medication correctly and your viral load goes undetectable, basically what it's saying there is that the possibility of the percentage of you passing on that virus to that next person becomes smaller. The window becomes smaller as time goes on. But so can that person get infected? Absolutely. It's just the roll of the dice, you know. So we just tell people, listen, you just play it smart, get tested, know your status. And like Leanne said, you know, why wait until the last minute? Know your status now. There is no reason why today's day that you cannot go and spend at least a half hour of your time to actually go get a rapid test, or even if it was a swab test, an OraSure test, and you get your results through the OraSure test within about 2 weeks. But the point comes down to at least you know your status. But there are people out there who really don't feel that they have to worry about this until they get slapped in their face, finding out that they're getting sick and they can't understand why. And the next thing you know, bang, they find out that they're HIV positive.
So let me ask you this, and I'm sure this is something that many people are curious about. Let's say you're going to your regular physician, assuming that you have such a thing, or you're not well and you go to a physician. Is there a formal reporting process if someone has a health screening and they find out that they have AIDS? Is that information passed to the county health department or the state health department or something?
Absolutely. By law, they have to report this, and it's for many reasons, but the top one is, one, for them to know what is actually the numbers within the area. Number
right.
two, how to treat that person, you know.
Well, isn't it true, Eric, with all communicable diseases like syphilis,
yes,
or
yes, yes,
tuberculosis,
all STDs,
or hep C?
Yes, all that.
Yeah,
STDs.
Mm-hmm. All of that stuff, because they're communicable diseases.
Yes.
I'm sorry, yeah.
So basically
what
it comes down to, they have to actually report this. Even if you're seeing just your everyday doctor out there, your general practitioner, you know, the question is your general practitioner offering this? You know, is that doctor who you've been seeing for the last 10, 15 years and becomes your best friend, is he willing to step up and say, hey, did you ever get tested for HIV? Or are you willing to turn around and say, hey, doc, I have never gotten tested before. Don't you think I might want to get tested? And they'll talk about it. And sure enough, I mean, hopefully they'll come to an understanding that, yeah, you should know your status. There is no reason why in today's day that anybody should not go and get tested and not know their status.
But also, Eric, you know, say someone finds out that their spouse has just found out their spouse cheated on them, okay? Mm-hmm. Not even once or many times, whatever, okay? And you go to your regular doctor's appointment. Is the doctor going to bring it up? You know, I mean, you have to bring it up. I mean, with infectious disease doctors, they have like 7 minutes per patient because they're so busy, okay? Mm-hmm. So I don't know about out there if people have just hours and hours that they can chit-chat with their doctor and, oh, you know, shoot the breeze and, oh, by the way, how's your life going and how's this and how's that and how's your stress and everything else? Most doctors that I hear about don't have that kind of time. Mm-hmm. So unless you bring up something like that, they're not going to say. I mean, because we have heard people say, you know, my doctor wouldn't test me. You know, like say someone who's you know, like, you know, this grandmother that we came across, you know, she was not getting tested. And sure enough, you know, her husband of 40 years or whatever gave her the virus. She was married. I guess the doctor didn't think to test her. You know, I don't know, you know. But I think as far as this, you know, the getting out to the public, you know, it's not like the numbers go out there, but no one's name goes out there. It's not like someone has to worry about, I'm going to read about it, my face is going to be, and my name's going to be in the paper, oh, so-and-so has AIDS. You know, it's not like that, you know. Not at all. You know, the HIPAA law is huge, you know, the privacy law. So,
right.
No, people don't have to worry about that. No, the privacy is very well protected in the state of Florida and probably across the country. No, I mean, it's the other side of the coin, Richard, that I'm talking about. The people
sure.
aren't asking for it. People aren't demanding it. It's not talked about. It's under the rug. It's shoved under the rug. It's not in our backyard. It's just, I guess it's just our dirty little secret. I don't know. I just don't know what to say. You know, Eric and I are on the front lines. We're the foot soldiers. That's how I describe us. You know, we're not the generals here, you know?
Yeah.
We're just out there on the front lines.
Why do you think it is that there's not funding for the public affairs announcements that there used to be on television? Is it just the shifting priorities? Is it the devil may care? Everyone's responsible for themselves anymore. We don't do public health. I mean, why do you think that funding has evaporated?
Well, I think there's a couple of things playing here. One, if you look at public service announcements, we do have public service announcements being run, but they run at a very odd time. They run late at night. I give you a good example, one that I use quite a bit. I won't use the name of the channel, but the point comes down to is that they literally run all their HIV public service announcements between the hours of 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. And they'll run like four of them back to back within that hour. That's it. You won't see it again. Now, radio stations, there are some within our community that do play a couple of public service announcements, but once again, is it during drive time? I've not heard one during drive time, unless it's during a special event, unless it's like during World AIDS Day or the actual this upcoming week was actually the week of prayer. These are big events, so they will spend a little more time with working with faith-based organizations, and the faith-based organizations will step up to the plate once in a while and actually say, hey, we need to get a public service announcement out there. But the trouble comes down to is that a lot of the funding that you're seeing that's being filtered down to our area, they're not being used for specifically, let's say, to generate just solely for public service announcements or get media involved. Their thing is education, treatment, and case management, peer advocacy, stuff like that. But when you start talking to these people who are in charge of the fund, you start telling them, well, look, listen, can we run an ad? Can we run some type of public service announcement or just something out there that we can inform our community? And they pretty much will say, well, yeah, sure, go for it, but it's on your time. You know, it's your dollar, not our dollar.
Yeah.
You know, the dollar we're giving you is specifically for the education of those who are positive, the education for those who are negative, but yet they are very few in regards to are being, once again, being tested.
Well,
and then, you know, they just don't, they don't filter it to the point of actually seeing the amount of funds that we used to see years ago. Like, example, that you have Magic Johnson. Magic Johnson, a foundation, actually runs public service announcements. But do you see him on TV as much as he was at one time before? No, you don't. It's just the way things have changed. You know, society has changed, so they, for some reason, they have gotten away from looking and using the media of getting the word out, you know, which, as you know, Richard, you know, the media, it's a huge tool, especially these days with Facebook, Twitter, you know, all these things that are out there that a person could use for their advantage of getting the word to letting people know you need to lose status.
But also, Eric, being in Florida, you know, I just look at my environment because that's where I am now, you know, with this virus, you know, seeing how it's moving about the state and the whole environment in Florida. And what isn't it anti-tourist? I mean, can you really imagine ads running, oh, come to Florida and get checked for your STDs, you know? It goes against the tourism industry. That's my feeling, you know? Like, I can see some pushback on that, you know, as far as going against tourism because – you know, I mean, it's this just this carefree, image that Florida has. Go to the beach, have fun, and kick back. That you know, I'm from the north. I mean, that's the image we have up there, you know. And isn't that a conflict, you know? I mean, and really, you know, where is health in our advertising? I mean, one minute you'll see an ad for dieting and the next minute you see an ad for pizza, you know. I mean, smoking seems to be, I don't know where we're at with cigarettes, you know. I mean, you don't see anti-cigarette ads like you did a long time ago. I mean, maybe it's, I don't smoke, so I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just, but, you know what I'm saying? As far as protecting your health in general, you know, as far as, stay healthy. Don't get sick. Don't eat that stuff. Get out and exercise. You know, you see ads about all that other stuff. Really, I don't. You know, so I kind of lump it in. So I see it as a conflict against the tourism industry. That's me personally. I don't see a lot of health ads. It's on us.
If people want to help your organization, how can they contact you?
Well, they could reach us either a couple of ways. One is by calling us directly to our office, which is 772-323-0204. Or they could call us through our cell, which is 772-453-1067. That's 772-453-1067. Or they could actually go to Facebook and type in Positive Mind and Body Support Group Network, and they would actually see our Facebook or even go to our website, which is positivemindandbody.wordpress.com. There are many, or just type in our name and Google it, and you'll see a variety of things that we have done in the community, and majority of them lead you to some way of contacting us, and we would guide that individual either into treatment or to get to know their status.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. I really appreciate you helping our audience understand what's going on today, and I wish both of you the best of health.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now I want to play one more of the Naples voices from the EPA hearing. This is a former board member.
After you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Frank on the Atlas for the record. Mr. Chairman, lady of the committee, and committee members, thank you for coming down here today and listening. I served on the Big Cypress Swamp Advisory Committee for over a decade. I probably looked at 150 well sites. Thank you, Mr. Garrett, too. I just want to share with you my thoughts. back then we had a hydrologist, Mr. James Hartwell, U.S. Geological Survey, retired. We had respected Dr. Taylor Alexander, eminent botanist. We had representatives, Mr. Doug Shelby of the Florida Petroleum Institute, and I represented the environmental and conservation community. It was with some trepidation that I went on this committee. I wasn't sure how it would work. It was a big difference then between the committee I was on and your committee. Your committee is now housed in under DEP. When I was on the committee, geology was more autonomous, and our committee members, our recommendation went to the governor of Florida and the cabinet members. It was a very public process. Many times we would have 30 or 40 people come in the field with us to look at these well sites. The media, representatives of other environmental groups, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was there, the Florida State people were there, and we sometimes these meetings were very contentious, but we stayed out there until we had agreement. When I first went on the committee, the old representative and Jerry Berry of Collier, we were enemies. We came to be collegial workers. And the governor and cabinet never, ever denied a recommendation we made. I like some of the questions y'all brought up during the committee discussion. I encourage you to continue to ask those type of questions and to have a collegial working relationship and think for yourself. And thank you.
Thank you.
Rob Glenn.
Yeah, before we go any further with any more of
I want to thank again independent producer Mr. Steve Malagodi for bringing us these voices. Many of us could not attend those hearings, but we were there very much in spirit and supported. And it's so valuable for us to hear the important, impassioned speeches that were delivered over there to explain to these people on this panel how important it is not to destroy Florida's aquifer. And now I want to invite my good friend, Ms. Jean Economos, and author Dale Slongwhite to discuss with us Ms. Longwhite's new book. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ms. Jean Economos and Ms. Slongwhite. Welcome.
Thank you.
Jean, what's new? We know you're doing important work helping to protect our farm workers who harvest our crops from the worst abuses of the pesticide community. What's new?
Well, we are still working very, very intensely to try and get some assistance for the former Lake Apopka farm workers, but some hopefully good news is on the horizon. The Environmental Protection Agency just a couple of weeks ago has issued proposed new and stronger regulations to protect farm workers from pesticide exposure. It's called the Worker Protection Standard, and right now we're beginning a 90 or possibly 120-day public comment period in which people can comment on these regulations, and hopefully there will be plenty of comments from farm workers, farm worker advocates, and people on our side to counterbalance what we expect will be pushback from the agricultural industry. So we have about 120 days we're expecting for public comment, after which EPA will look at those public comments, and we're hoping that by this time next year that we will have some improved work protection standards for farm workers.
Oh, that would
be good
news.
If anyone is interested in, absolutely, and if people are interested in making public comments, they can contact me and I can let them know how to do that. So that's the newest thing on the horizon. It doesn't directly help the Lake Apopka farm workers, but it will hopefully help future farm workers with slightly better protections from pesticide exposure.
Great, great. And now let me welcome especially Ms. Dale Slongwhite. Tell us about your new book, Dale.
Well, thank you. It's really good to be talking with you today.
I learned of the Lake Apopka farm worker situation in October of 2009. We had recently relocated to Florida, and I didn't know anything about how my food was grown or how it was harvested or anything like that. And I attended an environmental justice summit at Barry University School of Law, and Jeannie Economos was there. That is when we first met. And I was really horrified to learn how food was planted and harvested and what the farm workers went through. A lot of people know about the land and how it was polluted and about the lake and how it was polluted and how the alligators had problems and the thousand bird deaths. But what gets lost in the whole story of Lake Apopka are those people who crawled on their hands and knees in 100-degree heat planting and harvesting our food. And I'm interested in human beings, and so I decided to write their stories in their own words. I interviewed 11 farm workers and told their stories in their own words.
Wow. You know, there's been so many wonderful journalists who've done that sort of collection of stories. You stand in a long tradition of very, very important authors. I want to thank you for that work. What was the first thing that surprised you about this?
The first thing that surprised me was the fact that farm workers in that generation, who are still alive today and suffering greatly with what happened to them, is that they were not asked to leave the fields when the crop dusting planes came over. That was that came out in almost every interview. I spoke with one individual who would wear, now just remember, this is in the heat of summer or, you know, in the heat of Florida, 100 degrees yeah. out, would wear a hat, long-sleeve shirt, pants, and people would say, are you in there? Are you in there? And have so many clothes on. I spoke to others who have scars as a result of that, either scars on their legs or scars on their faces. That was the very first thing that was a shocker to me.
I have to say, when Dale and I first met at the Environmental Justice Summit in Orlando, Dale came up to me after the farm workers spoke on a panel and then in the question and answer period afterwards, and Dale said, oh, well, you know, I really want to write a book about this. And I have to admit shamefacedly that at first I thought, sure, everybody says that they want to do something, but very few people actually come through with it. And the fact that Dale has come through with this is a great joy, and it's real validation for the community. So we are very, very excited that Dale has done this and taken the time to let the farm workers' stories be told in their own voices, and that's what's really significant.
You know, I think that a lot of people don't appreciate the cultural chasm that you had to reach across. I'm sure there was some trepidation. I'm sure there was some unease about speaking candidly about one's life experience to someone who's not in the same community. How did you work to bridge that gap, Dale?
That is very true. What you said is very true. Trust was the initial issue. After all, I am white, and who had done most, what race had done most of this to them, and white. So there was definitely some trust issues. But because of Jeannie, I was able to bridge that. That really was the bridge. Jeannie, I couldn't have done this without you.
Well, you instilled a lot of trust in people, too, and so I think that that's really important. The community really got the sense that you were not in this for yourself, that you were really in this to tell their stories. And I want to say that to the community, does this solve their health care problems? No. Does this give them any compensation for what they experienced? No. But what it does do is it validates their lives and it validates their experiences. Because as Dale said earlier, one of the big problems is that the, especially the African American farm workers, feel like they have been completely lost in history, in the history of farm workers, just in the history of this community. We have been to, this past year, the Seminole County Historical Museum had a talk and a lecture about agriculture and women in agriculture, and so we went to it. And I think that they were a little taken aback that farm workers, African-American farm workers that lived through this history and whose parents and grandparents lived through it were there at this talk. And what's interesting and disturbing is that when you go to agricultural museums, history museums, lectures and talks, you hear people talk about, oh, the history of agriculture in Florida and the citrus industry and the vegetable industry, but you don't hear about the farm workers. And the African-American farm workers especially, there's some consciousness now about the Hispanic farm workers, but a lot of the African-American farm workers feel like they are invisible, and they've been made invisible. And this is a validation of their lives.
You know, in researching this book, I went to a program called 5,000 Years of History of Lake Apopka, and I had already interviewed 11 farm workers, and I was all excited. Great, I'm going to get some good information here. And I had spoken previously to a woman whose mother was a child and walked 320 miles from Panhandle down to Apopka in order to work on the muck farms. I had talked to people whose uncle had a store in Apopka since the 1920s. I mean, I had talked to a man, quote, whose father hoboed a train from Alabama with no shoes on. And when, so I thought I would really get a lot of information for my book with a program entitled 5,000 Years of History of Lake Apopka. And wouldn't you know, African Americans did not get mentioned except for one man who brought two slaves. I think the year was 1822. And the truth of the matter was that the backbone of these farms was on the backs of the African-American community. Many of them came straight out of slavery. Many of them took small boats down the intracoastal waterways, and they landed at, I think it was called Johnson's Farm or Johnson's Community, and then they would go to Mead's Bottom with these shanties with you could see through the roof and then get themselves set up on some kind of farm. And so, I mean, this goes back generations, and so you talk about being ignored. To me, the point was this was a point of history that was going to be lost unless somebody got it quick. And we've actually had a few deaths since I wrote the book, and so I have those stories, even though those people have passed.
Well, let me ask you a question. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Jeannie. Go ahead.
I just want to say I'm glad you mentioned that, Dale, because every event that we've done since then, I've kind of liked to dedicate any kinds of quilt showings and events to the four women who passed away last year, all African-American farm workers who worked for generations or decades on Lake Apopka and who were active in the community trying to fight against the social injustice and the pesticide exposure. And so I'd like to dedicate this, if I have just a second, to Willie Mae Williams, Angela Tanner, Betty Woods, and Louise C. So we are talking in their honor and in their memory today.
How wonderful. Dale, I was wondering, could I make a big imposition on you? Could you read us a passage, maybe 2 or 3 minutes?
Yes, I would be happy to do that. Let me just, I have something picked out here.
I'll tell you what,
I'll
give you a minute to do that while I talk to Jeannie for a second. Jeannie, so this lady wanders up to you and said, you know, hey, I want an introduction to some of your contacts. And I'm going to write a book, and you sort of said, "Yeah, right." What did you do to understand her bona fides?
Well, Dale gave me her card and her information, and I have to say, again, I'm a little embarrassed, but I am so busy that I kind of just put it aside, and I thought, well, I have a lot to do. I don't have time to pursue all these different things, because we have a long history of people promising to do things and then not coming through. And we even had people offer to make documentary films before, and then they just failed us. And even after they took film footage, and then they just never came through. We had lots of people offer. It's a very long story, which I won't go into on the phone, of people making promises and then never coming through. And so I basically just kind of thought, well, yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. And then a year later, there was the second annual Environmental Justice Summit, and Dale was there again. And she said, you know, I really want to do it. And so we just kind of picked up from there. And I have to say, Dale deserves the credit for being insistent on it and, you know, and being persistent. And thanks to her, you know, it's the book will be out in May. So it's thanks to her persistence for following through on that.
I can't believe we've gone this far without mentioning it. Dale, tell us the name of your book.
It's called Fed Up, The High Costs of Cheap Food.
So do you have your passage ready?
I do. I'm going to read from a woman. First, let me give you a little bit of terminology.
Please
when you
do.
Talk about growers, those are the individuals who own the farms. Well, what they do is hire crew leaders who are usually of the same nationality of the individuals who are working in the fields, called farm workers. So sometimes people confuse farmers with farm workers. No, farm workers are the ones bending down, kneeling all day long. Can you imagine that, crawling down the fields? But here, this is what one individual told me. To keep us motivated and to keep us high-spirited in the fields, no matter what the working conditions was, we used to sing. There was always someone in the field who could really sing. One woman might start off. 9 out of 10, she going to be a Christian woman. And she'd start off singing, run and don't look back, run and don't look back. And other workers would repeat, you better run and don't look back, you better run and don't look back. Another song we sing is, get right, church, and let's go home. It was one of our slave songs, and they had a lot of powerful meaning. Get right, church, and let's go home. I'm going home on the morning train. That means we fit into runaway. The train is our runaway. So we telling the slaves to get ready so we can run away. We don't have time for what's been going on in the labor camp, so we're going to run away. All the workers, they know those slave songs. We were taught those songs when we was a little girl. Another one is, I'm going to lay down my burden down by the riverside, down by the riverside. Ain't going to study war no more. Meaning, you better meet me down by the riverside because I'm laying all my burdens down. I have gotten tired of picking all those tomatoes, ain't getting paid, so I'm laying all this burden down. I'm going to be down by the riverside because we planning to book up. The history behind that is that, you know, a lot of times on these farms, you would see fences. And what would happen is the crew leader would tell the growers, I have got to put up a fence to protect the people. Well, in reality, what he was doing was keeping them in. It wasn't protection at all. So there were people who would come from some far-off place to work in the farms, and they would, you see, what the crew leader would hire would be somebody who would be addicted to alcohol or cigarettes, and he would supply them with that, but then deduct it from their pay. So at the end of the week, when they got paid, they really didn't have much left to go. This individual that I just read from, she would sneak out onto the camps because she lived locally, and she would cut the fence and sneak people out.
You mentioned pay, and I'm sure that pay didn't come up very often, or at least as necessary. How were these folks paid when they were paid, and was it by the season, by the month, by the day, so
sometimes
they could spend their money in the store?
Sometimes. sometimes it was by the day, sometimes it was by the week. Another problem was that Social Security was taken out of their pay many times, but not turned in. I spoke to one woman who, when she finally retired, went to file for Social Security and discovered that 9 years that she worked, the money was taken out but not put in. So her Social Security was much less.
That's too bad.
I think it's important.
How much were they paid? I'm sorry, Jean, go ahead.
Just one comment real quick. I think it's also important to understand that most of the farm workers that Dale interviewed were all alive and working in the fields before the Civil Rights Act was passed. And that's very significant because in addition to the conditions that farm workers experience just in general, it was before African Americans, it was when we still had Jim Crow laws in the South. And so you had that added layer of discrimination, and some of that comes out in these stories, and they're very powerful stories, and they have a lot of significance in terms of our overall history in this area.
You know, the thing of it is, what I wanted to do was take away the label farm worker. When we put labels on people, we no longer look at them as people. We look at them, oh, well, they're a farm worker. That's what they do. Once I asked Jeannie, well, why don't you just train these people to do something else? And she said something that was really impressed me. It was, this is a necessary job, but people should not have to suffer in order to do it. And I thought, wow, you're right. We all do need to eat, don't we? And what you just said, Jeannie, about the Jim Crow laws, et cetera, in 1938, a law was passed in Apopka that African Americans could not live or work on the other side of a particular railroad tracks. And that law held until 1978. I have stories of a lot of discrimination of people living there. But sickness, you know, Jeannie, we didn't even touch on the sickness. Many of these people have lupus, diabetes. Their children experienced autism and eczema and ADHD long before it hit the white community. Low birth weights, miscarriages. Lots and lots. One person told me she went to 14 funerals in one weekend. Unfortunately, Jeannie and I went to a funeral just a couple of weeks ago. How old was she, Jeannie? 43, leaving behind four children, and with lupus that went undiagnosed. So health care is another issue healthcare is not good as far as catching some of these diseases that need specific tests.
And the other issue is the person whose funeral we went to a couple of weeks ago, she did not work in the fields herself, but her mother did. And what worse we suspect is that a lot of the children and grandchildren of the former farm workers are experiencing health effects. And our science has not caught up to our technology. And so all these pesticides were approved and used. And only now is science starting to find out that some of these pesticides that were used do affect the second and third generation. And I think Amanda's death a couple of weeks ago to me, it's indicative of that. I can't prove it, but it definitely is suspect.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about methyl bromide. Cauliflower was grown on these plastic sheets, and the individuals that I spoke with, they could smell gas all day long. They work in planting this cauliflower. Then when it grows so much that they rip out the plastic sheets, and they're still smelling gas. And what they found out is with methyl bromide, well, if you look on the Environmental Protection Agency website, you will see that we no longer are able to use that. It depletes the ozone level. So if something is depleting the ozone level, they've now proven it causes kidney injury, lots of delayed symptoms of the nervous system. But, you know, years later we find this out. After all kinds of tests were done on animals, but the humans, oh, well.
The life of these people. I would imagine since they're getting transport from their homes to the fields, I imagine they have to pay for that transportation coming out of their modest salary.
You know, actually, they did not. But that was interesting, too. These people would have to leave their houses. Now, so what time did they have to get up? They had to leave their houses at 5 o'clock in the morning in order to – some of them walked 2 miles to the one pickup point where the, quote, the man in the truck would drive them to the field. And sometimes they'd get there, and if the field was wet – they couldn't harvest, so they would have to be sitting in this truck or bus and waiting. And then by the, one individual, I loved this term, she said, and we worked until dark 30. So then they didn't get home till 7 or 8 o'clock at night, dark 30.
So, you know, I noticed that your book is called Fed Up, the High Cost of Cheap Food. Describe the difficult life. You let these people tell their story in their own words. What do you draw from that? When you say the high cost of cheap food, you're basically talking about the heavy, heavy impact of this, of the low prices that we pay is because these people are being treated so poorly.
That's the implication, yes. Yes, that's
and
exactly
right. And I think
right.
It also... It also not only the high cost in terms of the impacts to human health, but also in the Lake Apopka is a good case study because we know Lake Apopka is the most contaminated large lake in Florida. We know about what happened with alligator reproductive problems and abnormalities and anomalies. We know about the fact that in 1998 and 99 there were over 1,000 birds that died. So we know that there's pesticide contamination on the farmlands of Lake Apopka, and yet instead of trying to transition to sustainable agriculture that would be better for the environment and for human health, the state just bought out the Lake Apopka farms, and the farmers that owned that land were just able to go other places and continuing farming in the same way, continuing to use chemicals instead of transitioning to other kinds of methods of farming that would protect not only farm workers but the environment but all of us and all of our health. And so I think Lake Apopka is a good lesson. It's a good case study. And in addition to the fact that it, Dale's book brings out the voices of the real people who, and they're very vibrant and important history and lives.
Well,
you brought out a good point, Jeannie, and I wanted to talk just a moment about Dr. Louis Gillette, who is in. Rather famous for his alligator study on Lake Apopka. In 1980 and 81, he was seeing 1,200 to 2,000 alligators a night in his study. By the end of the decade, he saw only 150. 1,200 to 2,000 down to 150. He called the alligator a sentinel species because what happens is that the toxins bioaccumulate. So an amoeba, you know, eats something, and then something eats the amoeba, and then it goes up and up and up the food chain. As it goes up, it bioaccumulates and becomes more and more and more, and the top species is an alligator. So he calls, and alligators don't wander far from where they're born. So when something happens to them, you know something happened to the direct environment where they were living. And what he said was, when you study a sentinel species, you know what's happening in that environment. And I think that word sentinel could be used about the whole Lake Apopka issue, that what's happened there, by telling the story of Lake Apopka, it's bigger than Lake Apopka. It's happening in other places, too.
Well, thank you both so much.
I think we have to be really careful for the...
Go ahead, Jean.
I'm sorry. We have
That's
to be really
okay.
careful about the whole Everglades restoration issue because I feel like the Everglades case, Lake Okeechobee, is a Lake Apopka waiting to happen. And if people aren't cognizant if they're just so intent upon getting the Everglades so-called cleaned up, just like Lake Apopka is so-called cleaned up. They're going to be in for some surprises. So we have to look at the environment, the people, and definitely raise up the voices of the farm workers.
Well, thank you both so much. Ms. Finley, we can get your book at Amazon.
Yes, you can pre-order it in Amazon.
That's great. Is it available both in ebook as well as hard copy?
It will be. I think by this summer it will be a Kindle.
Excellent. I want to congratulate you on your great book. Jean, thanks so much for joining us. Thank you both. And I wish you both best of luck in the near future. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We appreciate it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good night. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I want to play a quick example of our continuing support of the Naples project. Here is Mr. John Dwyer, who's going to speak at the Naples hearing.
What is it that makes Florida special? Professor Albert Pine at USF explains in his The Geologic History of Florida that the answer is written in stone. It is water. Pine traces our history back 700 million years. Beneath Florida lies the Florida Aquifer System, a huge 3 miles thick, porous and permeable zone extending from Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina, where it is charged by a rainfall and surface runoff, the whole way to the Florida Straits. Our aquifer is, however, seriously depleted, causing our water table to dramatically rise and fall during alternate wet and dry seasons. The elaborate internal pouring system buried within Florida's highly permeable carbonate rocks is the important freshwater resource that sustains the state. It is our fountain of youth. Florida is the garden beneath which rivers flow. Given Florida's limestone geology, we contend this current drilling for oil by acidizing or acid fracking in the Sunnyland Trend is not safe. The aquifers are not neatly separated by impermeable containment strata as the CAD arts depict. The seasonal water table variation creates transmissivity. In Collier, charts show that horizontal movement is slow in comparison to the saturated hydraulic conductivity. But there is flow. All rivers run to the sea. That poisons are entering our state's water supply has been underreported with astonishing regularity. Class II wells are subject to looser rules and less scrutiny than others designed for hazardous materials.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, one more of the speakers who spoke so eloquently at the Naples hearing. I'd like to introduce Mr. Matthew Schwartz. Matthew, welcome.
Hey, Rick. How you doing? Thanks for having
Pretty
me
good,
on.
Sir. Oh, it's our pleasure. Listen, you spoke so eloquently at the EPA hearing. Why don't you give us your perspective on this injection well, the fracking, the petroleum search in Florida? Please go ahead, sir.
Well, I haven't, you know, I just tuned into your program, so I'm not sure how much you've covered already, but I'll give you my perspective on it in a few sentences, maybe a few paragraphs. I'll try to boil it down. How far back do you want to go? Because really this story begins with a gentleman named Aaron Gift Collier, who made a lot of money in New York City in the outdoor advertising business, came down to Southwest Florida. I forgot exactly at the moment when he got here, but I know he was instrumental in funding and building the Tamiami Trail from Tampa to Miami, which I think opened its opened to traffic in 1923, so it was a long time before that. But the gentleman acquired over 1 million acres of land in Southwest Florida. I think most of it from most of the land between Marco Island and Fort Myers and all the way inland, so over 1 million acres. And as the family divested of these properties, sold properties, including a lot of properties that got sold to the federal and state government for some of our well-known public lands, they held on to the mineral rights. And that's really where this story begins, is a very large land-holding family that holds over 800,000 acres of mineral rights in Southwest Florida, including lands under the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, the Big Cypress National Preserve, the Fakahatchee Strand Preserve State Park, the Picayune State Forest, the Corkscrew Regional Ecosystem Watershed, the Audubon Corkscrew Swamp, Dinner Island, and I believe also the 10,000 Islands National Wildlife Refuge. So that's now handled by a family subsidiary called Collier Resources, and people are invited to go to their website, Collier Resources, and look at their frequently asked questions. It answers a lot of the questions about what's going on right now. And they have a mission to basically maximize profits of their holdings. So what we've got right now is an oil boom. They are leasing out huge chunks of this 800,000-plus acres to a number of different companies. The one that's getting the most attention right now is the Dan Hughes Company, because they're the ones that have the lease where this oil well next to the Golden Gate Estates is located. But there are numerous other companies involved in exploiting these leases, Kerogen, Brightburn, Burnett, Tocala, and all of them have gigantic leases. The Dan Hughes Company has 115,000 acres, and it includes chunks of those public lands that I mentioned just a minute ago. So that brings us up to the present, where one of the oil wells they decided to drill is a wildcat well, an exploratory oil well. To the west of it is the Golden Gate Estates, where John Dwyer and a number of the other folks you might have had on the program reside, don't want an oil well in their backyard. But also to the east, less than a mile, about three-quarters of a mile, is the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge. And, of course, panthers do not pay much attention to property lines on a map. They go where they go. So this area is highly used by Florida panthers, by black bears, by all kinds of critters that call the Western Everglades home. It's also important wetlands. The wetlands adjacent to this drill site drain into both the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge and the Picayune Strand State Forest to the south. Lots of different kinds of vegetation in there. And it's just a bad idea. It's a bad idea. The hearings that took place, there were two hearings that took place the other day.
Yeah.
The first one was the, I'm just kind of going through this, was the Big Cypress Swamp Advisory Committee meeting. Now, that one was an interesting one because that committee hasn't met in 25 years. And although the DEP, Department of Environmental Protection, at the beginning of the meeting told everybody, well, we're meeting because there's a lot of concern about the oil well next to people's homes, the truth is they met because two of us that had an administrative hearing in Fort Myers the week before told the DEP, you permitted this oil well without consulting with the advisory committee meeting, and that's a requirement by law. You don't get around that. And they said, okay, that's what happened.
Gosh, it was
so
an oversight.
So they did a funny thing. After they signed the permit, they called the advisory committee meeting to advise the member whether they should have signed the permit. But that's not the right order. So that's why the advisory committee met, and they got an earful. And then, of course, the EPA met because they're supposedly permitting. Well, they've already written a draft permit, but they're on the route to permitting a deep well injection well 2,200 feet down. Well, they'll take the wastewater that comes out of this drilling rig and after they've separated the oil and pump that back down under the ground underneath their numerous aquifers down there. They did say an interesting thing, though. I'll tell you, I'll just say two other things about these hearings. Besides the advisory committee meeting, one of the things that came out in the hearing, the administrative hearing in Fort Myers, that even had the judge very surprised, when they were looking at the permit, they sent it out for a consultation to both the State Fish and Wildlife Commission and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Both agencies, state and federal, said no comment for different reasons, but the end result was no comment. And the judge said, you mean if you send this out for consultation to the agencies and they don't comment, then everything is okay? And, yeah, I guess that's what they decided. If they got no consultation from the agencies and they feel that everything is okay. But the EPA, the administrator that was there, did say he's going to request what's called a biological opinion from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So that's a good thing. I mean, it doesn't mean that they're going to stop it, but at least means that some agency is going to give this oil well a review in terms of its impact to listed species. And, of course, the most well-known listed species in that area is the Florida panther. And there's a lot of conflict about that we can get into.
Let me ask you a question. You know, it seems from what I've heard that they made a big deal, and even Florida Fish and Wildlife testified that, well, we've had oil wells out there for a long time. Doesn't seem to have bothered the panthers a bit. Now, it seems to me you don't have to have much brain wattage to say, wait a minute, a pump sitting in a field all by itself with very little traffic is one thing, but an active industrial site where you're going to be drilling multiple holes, you're going to be putting pipes out in multiple directions, now you've got a deep injection well, you're going to have an industrial process that's going to separate, theoretically, the water from all those terrible things that have to be kept secret for proprietary reasons, trucks going in and out, you don't have to have much genius to decide to understand that these are very different things.
Right. And I think if you NPR covered that hearing where Daryl Land of the Fish and Wildlife Commission spoke about that, and I listened to it carefully, and it sounded like in the beginning he was about to say there's no problem with exploratory well. Then he changed it to oil extraction. So he went from oil exploration to oil extraction. That's what it sounded like to me. But he was very careful to say oil extraction, which is a pump sitting above ground. Going in with an exploratory well into an area that's never had anything like that. I mean, the field that they're going to put this on was cleared. That's about all you can say about it. It was cleared. Ditches were dug years ago so water could drain off and they can use this area for agriculture. Those ditches are actually interesting in and of itself because those ditches that made this little field that they're going to put the oil well officially not a wetland. When I asked the South Florida Water Management District, where do these ditches drain into? They had no idea, which is amazing. Because they're doing the environmental resource permitting with regard to hydrology, and they didn't know where the ditches adjacent to this oil well were draining into. In fact, they do drain into the Panther Refuge. They drain down into that canal that runs along the north side of 75 and then into the Picayune Strand State Forest, which is the site of a Everglades restoration project to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars.
But
I wanted to get back to the conflict between me and Daryl.
I do want to go back, or
he's not saying what's going on. There's plenty of research that shows that going into an area, bringing in hundreds of trucks, many hundreds of trucks, to bring in the fill material, bringing in the pipes, bringing in the generators, creating lights, noise. When they start out the drilling, they've got to pound a 24-inch wide diameter steel pipe. It's called a conductor pipe to start it off. 250 feet down into the ground. They pound it in with a pile driver type machine. There's a lot of noise with that. Panthers are going to leave. Black bear are going to leave. All kinds of critters are going to be affected by it. You can't interview each panther, but we know that panthers are affected by new noises, sights, vibrations in their environment. If a panther leaves, you've got three things that can happen. They can find a new home. There's not a lot of real estate out there for them to go to. They could possibly move into an area where they have to go across a highway like State Road 29 or I-75, run the risk of getting hit. A panther could be displaced into another panther's home range. There could be a fight. That's the second leading cause of death for panthers. It's called intraspecific aggression. You could have a panther-on-panther fight to the death. Or you could have a female panther with a den in the area. There's been three dens in the vicinity of this well who might decide to leave the den. And any kittens that she has in there are going to be abandoned. They're not going to survive. So a lot of consequences for what's going on here.
When a bureaucrat says they don't know, it's my experience that typically what's really going on is that they do know, but they dare not tell the truth. Is that your experience? They don't know where those drainage trenches.
My sense, to be honest, is that they didn't know. My sense was that they didn't know. I've been doing this for some time, Rick, and there's a lot of things. There's so many things that I run into when I'm dealing with the agencies that they don't know, or just ridiculous things that they say that if you look at it, like, for example, just north of this drill site, there's a road called Oil Well Road, and it's from basically from old oil wells in the area. And it was widened from a little two-lane road to something approaching a six-lane road with a gigantic median in between. It goes right across a major strand called Camp Key Strand, which is a corridor for Florida Panthers. And in their biological opinion for that road, they said, well, just because the road is going from two lanes to six lanes, that's not going to hurt panthers. Lanes don't kill panthers. Cars do. And just because the road is getting bigger, it doesn't mean that there's going to be more traffic on the road. Therefore, the impact of this road is negligible. And this is the kind of thing I could give you numerous examples in biological opinions. And I would guess, to be honest with you, that they didn't know, that they didn't look at it, they didn't examine it, they didn't go to the site and look and say, where do these ditches drain into? They just didn't do it for whatever reason.
Well, if you plop something down in the middle of a nature preserve and you get drainage off of that area, there's no other place for it to go. Of course, it might be magical like the BP oil that just disappeared in the Gulf.
It won't disappear. It won't. What they're relying on, and this let's be clear, though, this particular well, the well that's getting all the attention, 1353H is the application, is not in the Panther Refuge. It's just outside of it. But the use company has, in fact, leased big chunks of the refuge, and they're starting outside the refuge, but their intent is obviously to go in. But hopefully that's not going to happen. In terms of what they're relying on to keep the spills from going off the pad, they said they're going to build a two-foot berm, kind of, if you picture kind of a moat around a castle. So you build a levee up 2 feet around the perimeter of the area they're working. And yeah, all the oil that spills or any other chemicals that spills are supposed to go into this little moat and not pass through that limestone berm that they're going to build, which is pretty hard to imagine. And, of course, it depends what spills and how much spills and where it spills, but there's no spill contingency plan either. That's something else that came up in the advisory committee meeting and that one of the committee members actually brought up. What are you going to do if there's a spill? Where's the contingency plan? So a lot of questions about all of this stuff, but I think the real risk that people in your audience need to know about is that this use lease or this well we're talking about is the very, very tip of an iceberg, because use has leased 115,000 acres. They've got another well going on about 10 miles from this one. Apparently that one has some kind of problems. I drove by it the other day. I saw two derricks kind of holding something up. When I asked the DEP about it, they said, well, they're still in their 1 year of, what's that word, where they can't talk about anything. I forget exactly the word I'm thinking of right now. But anyway, they can't tell me what the problem is, but apparently there's a problem with that well. Their intent is to go throughout that 115,000-acre lease. Another company called Tocala has leased 100,000 acres for seismic testing just north of the refuge. They're going to be drilling holes in the ground and shooting off dynamite and having these geophones spread out throughout the area to listen to the seismic vibrations and figure out where the oil is there. Burnett is a company that's leased over 200,000 acres, I think close to 240,000 acres in the Big Cypress National Preserve, in the best of the best of the panther habitat in there, the Addition Lands, Bear Island, Corn Dance Unit, Turner River. And they're going to be doing a different type of seismic testing using these things called thumper trucks, where they bring these trucks in and they pound the ground and listen to the vibrations to figure out where the oil is. So if you add up those three leases alone, that's close to 450,000 acres of the Western Everglades. It's a lot of land. It's a lot of land that's going that might turn into oil fields if we're not vigilant and on top of this.
Well, I remember once upon a time, you used to have to do an EIS study, environmental impact study, before you tampered with the delicate wetlands, especially, not to mention national parks and preserves and panther habitats. Has all this been waived?
No, it hasn't. And, you know, it's different jurisdictions. So oil is a funny thing. I mean, minerals in general in the United States have a lot of – they're kind of woven into the fabric of that country. You know, as the West developed, the railroads went west. They logged. They mined. So those kind of activities, extractive activities on the land, are kind of woven into a lot of our laws. EISs, environmental impact statements, is on the federal side. So if and when the permit does happen for the Big Cypress National Preserve or inside the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, these are federal lands, federally public lands, there probably will be environmental impact statements. When it's private lands, like this oil well, is actually not only is the mineral rights owned by the Colliers, but the surface rights are owned by them as well. It just goes through pretty much the DEP. And like I said, their DEP oil and gas department is run by geologists and engineers. They know that stuff. They know that. They know what they're doing. They could tell you whether plumbing is hooked up right. They have some idea, although maybe they could give you a better idea of what's going on there geologically. But when it comes to surface impacts, wetlands, hydrology, plants, wildlife, endangered species, they have no knowledge at all. They sent it out for review by the state and federal wildlife agencies. They got nothing back. They still went ahead and signed the permit. So, no, there was no EIS. There wasn't even any review in this case on anything. And this committee hastily... Go ahead.
I was going to say they're going to permit first and ask questions later, huh?
Well, they weren't even planning on asking questions. They've been permitting for a long time. One of the questions that I asked the representative from DEP during the hearing who was involved with signing the permit is, have you ever – and by the way, I was my own lawyer there. That was a pretty interesting experience. I've never done that before. I've done a lot of things in my life. I've never represented myself. But I just couldn't let this one go, even though I didn't have the money for a lawyer. So I went ahead and did it pro se. And, you know, I watched Perry Mason a little bit, so I did the best I could.
There you go.
But the question I asked was Steve Spencer, who was one of the folks involved with permitting this on behalf of the DEP, was, have you ever consulted with the FWC on any oil well in Florida? And he said, yeah, we've sent out applications for consultation. I said, have you ever gotten a response? He said, not to my knowledge. So apparently this is something new. I mean, this entire review process that we're demanding is brand new to these folks. These permits have been going on for years, not in a big way, in a kind of a small way. But now suddenly they're in the limelight. Suddenly folks that we never heard of before, parts of the Department of Environmental Protection we never heard of before, are coming into public knowledge, and there's a lot more scrutiny. So I think that what's really good about all this is people are on top of it. I mean, it started out with just the homeowners who got their notice saying, this is where you go if you – this is your evacuation route in case you smell hydrogen sulfide gas. Now the whole state is involved. I mean, I went out afterwards with some of the students who drove down from Florida State University in Tallahassee. It was good. You know, it's good. I mean, it's from Tallahassee to Naples, and I saw a lot of people at that meeting, people from Miami, people from Broward, people from Palm Beach County, people from Orlando, people from everywhere. I mean, the whole state kind of really converged. That doesn't happen all that often. And we're going to need all those hundreds of people that were at that meeting and many more to be able to stop what's coming. Because these folks, I mean, I told you I represented myself. Well, the Dan Hughes Company was represented by three attorneys. high-priced attorneys, good ones. And I just basically did what I could do. But looks like, you know, we did get the advisory committee meeting to meet. It's a tough situation, though, because each one of these permits kind of goes through on its own. It's not like there's some blanket process that we can apply over the whole thing unless we get some legislators to change some of the legislation involved with oil and gas drilling. Otherwise, each one kind of comes up individually. And it's tough, you know, when you have to fight each one, and you've got multiple applications in the works right now. So we've got a tough fight ahead of us.
Let me, I'd like to play this quick interview that Steve Malagodi did with those FSU students and get you to comment on it after the piece, okay?
Sure, go ahead.
Thanks.
Well, anyway, we're here with a group of students from Florida State University, going to school in Tallahassee, and we're all the way down in Naples. So why doesn't one of you tell us why you're here?
Hi, yeah. So we're all on spring break, but none of us support fracking in Florida. We've actually been working on an awareness campaign with Rethink Energy Florida in Tallahassee. So we're trying to get the community up there to understand what's happening down here in Naples. A lot of people don't even know what fracking is. So we came down here to show our support.
Well, how did you find out about it?
I'm not sure. I've known about it for a while. They hosted two documentaries, Gasland 1 and Gasland 2, up in Tallahassee. So we've known about fracking elsewhere. But then we connected with Preserve Our Paradise, and they told us a little bit about what's going on down here.
So this isn't actually, they're not at the fracking process quite yet here in South Florida. So how does this coincide with your concern with the fracking permits? And there are fracking permits being issued in North Florida.
Right. Well, this is just important. It's preventing, if the EPA doesn't, I guess if they decide to reject the wells, dispose the wells, then ultimately we hope that would stop fracking all over Florida. But this is a great place to start since so many people are coming out and know about the situation. But there are two bills in Tallahassee right now concerning fracking that people have been working on, lobbying.
Is it the fracking procedure that bothers you, or are you opposed to fossil fuel development anywhere, or what's your position there? Where are you on that?
Definitely all of the above. Fracking is a big concern in Florida because of our aquifers, and we don't want to ruin our water and our habitat. Definitely in the Everglades is a big concern. But we're against fossil fuels, I think I can speak for all of us, and definitely promoting solar energy and renewable energy here in Florida.
So have you been involved in the Keystone debate at all?
Yeah, a little bit. We haven't been able to go up to D.C. to any of the rallies, but we've definitely been involved with petitioning at Florida State.
Are these separate issues for you, or does this all come together in your mind as one big thing?
I think all environmental issues can combine. They all affect one another, and definitely with big oil companies protesting against Keystone XL and the fracking companies come together.
Okay, great.
So what's your experience? You talk to these college kids. Are they informed? They sound informed in this interview.
Yeah, you know, and Steve did a great job in the interview. I think he's a retired journalist, but he really does do a good job when he does these interviews. You too, Rick. But aside from that, you know, it's a tough question. 2 weeks ago, I had my amateur lawyer hat on. I'm going to put my amateur geologist hat on now.
Sure.
To my knowledge, the DEP is saying that this oil well, the one that we're talking about next to the gate, Golden Gate, and the refuge, is not involved fracking. However, that doesn't mean that fracking is not something that can come down the line later on. They're going down 2 miles, they're turning horizontal, and going another mile horizontal in the direction of the refuge. One of the things that's different about this well from some of the other wells that have been drilled, most of the other wells have been in what's called the Upper Sunnyland Formation, which is an oil-bearing deposit about 2 miles down. This is called the Lower Sunnyland. And a couple of years ago, a petroleum geologist wrote a piece about oil shale in southern Florida and an oil play in south southern Florida. And part of what is driving this current boom is this notion that there may be a gigantic amount of oil in what's called the Lower Sunnyland Formation. Only one well so far drilled into the Lower Sunnyland has turned up oil in a profitable amount. But the idea is that the 120 million barrels of oil that have come up out of Southwest Florida so far, the source of that is the Lower Sunnyland. And the idea is that that oil might be too hard packed. In other words, the granules down there might be too close together. The oil doesn't flow. And that's going to be very tempting then for people that want to take advantage of fracking technology. And fracking is obviously fracturing rock. and opening up fissures in the rock to allow that oil to flow down into the horizontal borehole and then get it out. I'm worried about that in the future for sure, because if you take the price of oil, $100 a barrel right now, and you multiply it by the 120 million barrels that have come out of Southwest Florida so far, and the idea that all that oil that they've taken out so far has its source in the lower Sunnyland, and you've got these hundreds of thousands of leases going out, and you've got this horizontal drilling technology where they can turn on a dime, and you've got the fracking technology that's available to them to open up those areas. I think it's a very dangerous situation, and I think it's extremely dangerous not only because the technology is so risky, but the amount of money to be made when you do the math, it's just a huge amount of money, and these folks are just salivating. You would think that a company like the Colliers that has a county named after them, that has high schools and hospitals named after them, and has all kinds of business enterprises would say, you know, we've got enough. We don't need to start going into these environmentally sensitive lands next to people's homes and create all this ruckus. But in fact, the potential money, I think, is what's driving this. The students are great. I mean, they're, you know, I didn't, when we went out, it was a few of the middle-aged guys like me from the meeting and about five of the students, and we talked about kind of nothing. I think we'd had enough with the oil. I think that the fact that these folks are engaged in this process is wonderful. I think they're well aware that Florida's energy portfolio is somewhat ridiculous, that we're the Sunshine State. We have more solar potential than any state in the eastern United States by far in terms of the amount of sun that we get. Even though we have cloudy days, we're south, we get a high-intensity sun. We're not using any of it. And we're drilling for oil in the most vulnerable state when you think about climate change. And you think about, and every time you look at it, I just read an article earlier today, scientists looking at Greenland, and once again, it's melting quicker than they thought. That's an old story. Every time they look at ice caps, it's melting quicker than they thought. So, and we know, you know, Florida is what it is. The Everglades, the entire Everglades is less than a meter above sea level. All of our coastal areas, if we get a meter of sea level rise, we've got serious problems here. And here we are extracting oil out of the lower Sunnyland formation of the Sunshine State, which when burned will turn into massive amounts of CO2, and we're just hastening our own doom. And it's great that the students are thinking about these issues, that they are, you know, coming down here from our state university to lend their voices to us, lend their support. I would like to see the opposite happen. I think that people from South Florida, I'd like to see us go to Tallahassee and take this to them, take this to Herschel Vineyard in the Department of Environmental Protection and confront him directly on his permitting process and the future of our state, because this is not a way to build a sustainable state.
You know, I had a class of intelligent, literate, knowledgeable students Tuesday night in Palm Beach County, and not one of them was even familiar with the term fracking. Not one of them was aware of the risk of deep well injection. Not one of them was aware that Florida was even being pursued as an energy oil state. And when they heard it, they were flabbergasted. I only wish that our environmental regulators were as flabbergasted. Matthew, thank you so much for joining me. If I could ask you one final question, I would say, how many people would you guesstimate attended that hearing? Or those two hearings?
It was, well, people were saying 200 to 300. It looked like that to me. The entire room where it was being held was packed. In fact, they weren't allowing people in at one point. They were kind of shuffling them into a kitchen area or outside the room, and you could only get in when somebody left. So I think 200 to 300 is probably accurate. I didn't do a count, but it was a good turnout, and I did see, like I said, people from all over the state have been down here since 95. I know a lot of folks from all over, and we had a good representation from everywhere. I think you know, I think as it grows, those students that you speak to will learn about this issue, The press has certainly covered it. The majority of it, you know, has been in Southwest Florida. It hasn't really. There's been a few stories locally in Broward County and
I was going to ask you if you've seen any of the Herald or the Sun Sentinel.
The Herald did a great piece on this in the very beginning in May of 2013. They did a kind of overview on it. They haven't really been focused on it very much. I think the Sun Sentinels might maybe done one or two stories on it. Most of the vast majority of the coverage, well over 90%, has just been in the Naples-Fort Myers area, which is, frankly, a small media market. I mean, I speak to people in Tallahassee. They're not seeing any coverage of it in Tallahassee news. I did a interview at the hearing with NPR. I thought it was a local affiliate. I thought it was the affiliate out of Florida Gulf Coast University. Suddenly I'm getting emails from around the country, and apparently it was the national All Things Considered. So that was a national story and generated some interest. Newsweek did a piece a couple of weeks ago on it, which was a national story.
I heard an NPR piece on it. I thought it was rather dismissive. It was a lot of that. On the one hand, on the other hand, nobody really knows OL. Sort of tenor.
Well, that's a lot of environmental journalism is, well, Matt Schwartz of South Florida Wildlands Association says it will affect panthers. Darrell Land of the Fish and Wildlife Commission says it won't. What do you think? You know, it's kind of that's the format that I generally see in a lot of journalism. But that's, you know, they're trying to cover the news. They're trying to cover it informationally. That's why I write these very long action alerts, and people say, hey, if I wanted to read War and Peace, I would have bought, I would have bought it. But I throw a lot of information into those action alerts I send out. I've also been putting a lot of information on my Facebook page. I write very long posts on Facebook, and people are invited to go to South Florida Wildlands Association Facebook page. I had a nice helicopter tour today over a nice part of the preserve, which could be drilled one day. There's so much information, Rick. It's complicated legally. It's complicated policy-wise. It's complicated geologically. In terms of energy, people, you know, there's a lot of people who say, hey, I'm driving a car. You're driving a car. Where are we going to get the energy from? We need to be energy self-sufficient. So there's so many levels to this and so many aspects of it that we can discuss. I'll just say one thing. When I came down here from New York City, where cars aren't really a part of our culture. So I don't own a car when I live in New York. And I came down to Florida, and I'd say for the first 2.5 years, South Florida, I didn't have a car. But eventually I found out that I couldn't really move. I mean, it was so limited, and I finally broke down and got a car. But people are not responsible to a large extent for their culture, and, you know, having them wake up to the culture they're living in and saying, well, wait a minute, this lifestyle that we're living, this culture that we're living in is destroying not only the Everglades, but our planet. And getting people to think in that way, you know, think, it's complicated. And, you know, people have a lot to do in their lives, let alone to start reading about Florida geology and oil formations and Florida statutes and the code of, you know, federal regulations and the EIS and the Endangered Species Act and all the things they really need to grasp to understand how this whole thing is playing out. But,
well, you know,
I think most people realize it's not a good thing.
The Palm Beach Water Department has an interesting approach to getting results for their water studies. They just order their technicians who are taking water samples to bring back the kind of samples they want to see. Front page story, Palm Beach Post today. Listen, Matthew, thank you so much.
Really?
Yeah. Front
good
page story.
Story,
Palm Beach. Definitely look it up.
I'll take a look at it. good story. Yeah, Rick, we could talk forever. Thanks a lot for having me on again, and we'll talk soon.
I hope so. Thank you so much again for joining us.
Take care.
Us.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I also want to congratulate my good friends and fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, and Anita Stewart, her show Wise Women Media, Susan Nylon of the Nylon Report, Sita Bigwheel and the Sita Media, Harriet Lerman and her show The Voice of the People. And I must thank again for his dedication, independent producer Steve Stephen Malagodi, who provided us with the quips and quotes and interview segments from the Naples hearings this past Tuesday. Stephen, thank you so much. These are so important for people to hear. Couldn't have done it without you, buddy. You guys have a good night. We'll talk to you next week. Next week, our PNN show will feature the charming stylings and interview of Miss Meredith Ockman and her friends. So tune in next week. Talk to you soon. Rick Spezak, News Director, Progressive News Network. Bye-bye.